news, weather, truth, and fun. We're iHub Radio, homegrown in the Coachella Valley. For a fresh take on the news with Anita Rufus, you won't know if you don't listen.
And thank you so much for listening. This is Anita Rufus. I am here live today, although this is the last day we'll be doing a live show on Saturday. We're going to start doing all podcasts here at iHub Radio, at least for a while. And I appreciate you tuning in, and I will try and give you information about how to find me after this, if I can figure it out for myself. I'm a little out of breath because Brian, who's doing the board for me, Brian and I, we were just spraying and wiping and all the things you have to do because, you know, there's this virus going around. I don't know if you've heard about it. As of today, the latest numbers I have, just in the United States, we now have over 2.2 million confirmed cases. And no, that's not just because we're doing a lot of testing. In fact, in some places, we're doing less testing than we were. It isn't testing that tells us how many cases there are. It's testing that helps us find how many cases there are. More than 2.2 million in the United States. We have over 120,000 deaths now. And the experts consider that that's actually undercounting because of lots of reasons that I won't go into right now. But it is a bit disturbing. Okay, it's more than a bit disturbing. That of the entire world population and the figures that have been accounted for as best we can tell, the United States has 25% of the deaths in the world. Part of the reason for that is we clamped down later than we should have, so it was already working its way through the country. Part of the reason for that is that this has not been well run, managed, organized from the federal level. And I will get into a segment on Trump today because I'm just up to here with it. But the World Health Organization has issued a warning that the coronavirus pandemic is entering a new and dangerous phase. I am sorry to tell you that. There were more than 150,000 new cases reported just on Thursday, the most so far for a single day. 81 countries around the world have seen a growth in cases over the past 2 weeks. Only 36 countries have seen a decline. And in spite of the fact that there are some countries like South Korea, like New Zealand, that have done really well at containing the number of cases, nevertheless, only 36 countries throughout the world have seen declines in the last 2 weeks. In our country, South Carolina and Florida set record highs for new daily cases this week. And Texas has become the sixth state out of 50 to surpass 100,000 infections. By the way, the state, if you want to know, the state that has had the best results when it comes to the virus is Hawaii. And part of the very few cases, very few deaths. And part of the reason is they've had a real serious lockdown that people have observed. People cannot go outside without masks. And anyone who is flying into the islands must self-quarantine for 2 weeks to make sure that they have no symptoms. Mask wearing. I wear a mask everywhere I go outside. I am very unhappy with people who walk around without a mask. I'm not one, surprisingly enough, for those who know me, I am not one to go up and confront people on the street. Why aren't you wearing a mask? But when I walk past somebody on the street who thinks that they're just out walking by themselves or walking their dog by themselves, that they don't need to be wearing a mask, but when I walk past them, I just point at my mask as I pass. Now, there's a lot of people that just will not wear masks. They think it's about their personal freedom. And in some cases, it's also now been identified as having political implications. How stupid is that? I remember when we were fighting over things, public health initiatives, things like if you're riding a motorcycle, you have to wear a helmet.
Well, I don't want to have to wear a helmet. I'm taking the risk.
Oh, really? So if you're thrown off your motorcycle because you hit an oil slick or because some car doesn't see you and makes a quick lane change, and you get knocked off your bike and you smash your head up, you don't want us to bother giving you medical help? You don't want the rest of us, the nurses, the doctors, those of us who pay for health insurance, you don't want us to have any responsibility? We should just leave you lying there bleeding out on the side of the road? Get real. Seatbelts in cars. I was one of the people who hated the idea of a seatbelt. I don't like the feeling of being constrained. In fact, to tell you the truth, I don't like wearing a mask because it's hard for me to breathe. I get dizzy. I'm supposed to go start working out again next week at the cardio rehab. They called me and they said they're reopening and they're keeping everything safe and they're going to have very few people in there at the same time. And of course, we'll all be wearing masks. I don't think I'm going to go because there's no way I can exercise while I'm wearing a mask. I can barely walk to the mailbox while I'm wearing a mask. Smoking in bars and restaurants. It took us a long time to get rid of that, and I'm a smoker, and I didn't appreciate it. In fact, I still remember when I was running for Congress, I made a trip to Washington, D.C., and at that time, in California, it was against the law to smoke in a bar or a restaurant, especially in a restaurant. I remember walking into a restaurant after several months of living like that in California. I walked into this restaurant in Washington, D.C., and as I walked in the door, the maitre d' said, "Smoking or non?" And I didn't know what to say. It was like somebody was speaking a foreign language. I couldn't believe it. But these are arguments we have made over time about our right to personal liberty. And yet, there are societal implications for not wearing a helmet, not having your seatbelt on, smoking in a restaurant where there are some people who are incredibly allergic to secondhand smoke, even if you don't believe that it causes secondary illnesses. All of those measures that we finally put into law and that we enforce, all of those provoked lots of fights over the idea of personal liberty. So if you're not wearing a mask because I'm a free person and I can make my own choice, well, guess what? You're also making a choice for everybody else that you interact with. And if you haven't seen all the articles about droplets, those that come out of your mouth when you are talking, even in a low voice, even calmly, especially if you're yelling at a sporting event or a political rally. If you cough, if you sneeze, those droplets go out not just right in front of your face, but for many feet beyond you. And they can hang in the air, or they can attach themselves, especially to metal, handrails, phones. What are you doing to make a difference for other people? wearing a mask is at least a start. And now, in California, the governor has once again said, hey, guess what? We're going to enforce it. If you're out in public in any way, you must wear a mask. Now, I was interested to find out that the Associated Press started a series called One Good Thing. And what they were trying to do was to focus on the kinds of sacrifices people are making to benefit other people beyond just wearing a mask. There are ways, both small and big, that people are making a difference for others or acknowledging others while we're going through this difficult time of separation or feeling homebound or not liking the idea of having to wear a mask just to go out and walk your dog by yourself. Some people have been doing chalk messages on the sidewalk that leads up to their house, thanking postal workers for being out, for being out there delivering the mail. Or writing a message in chalk in front of a hospital so that when hospital workers come to work, they see something that says thank you. We know about every night in New York at a certain time, everybody goes out on their balcony or out on their front porch and starts banging pots and pans and clapping hands. And see, that's the stuff that makes me cry. Because I feel like I'm not doing enough. In Rio de Janeiro, a firefighter was sharing his love of music. He did one of those hydraulic ladders that was up 150 feet. And he played on his trumpet a version of opera for people who were cooped up in their apartments. The National Orchestra of France did a virtual rendition of Bolero with each musician playing alone at home. And we've seen a lot of those things online where creative, artistic people are trying to share their talents to connect with people even though they can't connect literally in person. There are lots of people who are delivering meals to poor people, to elderly shut-ins. There are volunteers who are feeding hungry animals. A Brooklyn caterer in New York made meals for Holocaust survivors who were shut in. Over 1,000 deliveries a week and over 10,000 volunteers are working with a Yale student on a delivery service called Invisible Hands. What are you doing to make a difference? At the very least, you ought to at least be wearing a mask. When we come back, I want to talk about race. I've done this before. I'm going to do it again because I am just stunned at how many people are tone deaf or blind, not to their own personal feelings, but to what is ingrained in our society. This is Anita Rufus, and you are listening to iHub Radio.
Live from Palm Springs, she calls it as she sees it. Local talk that's moving the needle. Here's Anita Rufus on iHub Radio.
Okay, I just shared a story with Brian during the break, and I want to share it with you. You know I'm a crier. I tear up lots of times when I'm talking about stuff on the radio. It's just something I do. I cry at almost everything. I especially cry at times when people come together to make a difference. I mean, I tear up when I walk into the grocery store and see everybody with a mask because it makes me realize we are all in this together. Okay, so this past week there was a wonderful town hall on CNN that was the Muppets and a couple, Dr. Sanjay Gupta was on, and anyway, it was children and their parents asking questions about the virus and about feeling shut in the house and not being able to go to school and things like that. And these kids were amazing. And I tend to cry whenever I see the Muppet characters anyway, just because what they represent to me is the kind of outreach and the beautiful learning techniques that over all these years the Muppets have done with young children. So there were young children and their parents who were pictured asking questions, and a four-year-old girl, 4 years old, this cute little girl, and she looks at Elmo and she says, "When will I get to play with my friends?" And of course, I'm just bawling my head off. It was a wonderful show. And if it's possible to pull it up, some of the questions that these kids and their parents were asking are not the kinds of questions we're used to hearing on the normal town halls. They were much more specific and much more geared toward children. And one of the things that I saw, they were asking about, one of the parents was asking about how to continue teaching children at home. And they showed something that I had never seen before, and maybe those of you who are parents of young children are aware of this, but if you're not, I thought it was one of the coolest ideas ever. You can hold a scavenger hunt inside your own house using the alphabet with very young kids who are just learning their letters. Okay, go and find me something that starts with an R. It's a great thing. First of all, it gives kids a chance to run around, which they desperately need. But it's a wonderful way to teach the alphabet, and it's a great way to involve kids in things that you can do that are learning activities that don't have to be heavy and tedious and controlled. Anyway, I thought it was a terrific idea. And, you know, we have to find ways to keep ourselves focused and aware and alert and not fall into depression and fear. And the truth is, while we are stuck in our homes for so much of the time, there are some really serious things going on that we are not aware of and that are not getting reported so that we can make a difference. And this is something that you should sensitize yourself to do. We all have neighbors, we have friends, we have people we talk to. The normal reporters of child abuse are teachers, doctors, nurses, family members. And right now, with children so confined and not going to school, and most of us not going to routine doctor's appointments, those who might be aware of child abuse, child sexual abuse, physical abuse, are not able to report those things and therefore get some help for kids who are in a situation where they have nobody they can talk to tell what's going on, even if they would. Domestic violence, which of course I hate to call domestic because that makes it sound tame, but spousal abuse, partner abuse, the normal people who would be aware of it, who might be able to report it, or who might be able to give support to somebody going through it, family members, friends. These are people we're not seeing right now. We're not having a lot of social interaction. And as a result, those things are not getting reported. This is one of the ways you can make a difference. If you feel that there is something wrong going on, ask questions, or at the very least, let somebody know you are there and willing to listen or to be of help. These are serious issues, and in many cases, they are going unreported. And when that's what's happening, then dire circumstances will be the fallout throughout somebody's whole life. Okay, that's enough of my sermonizing for today. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal. I appreciate you listening. This will be my last live show on Saturday for a while, but we're going to be doing podcasts and you'll be able to find me. I'm going to give you all that information in the next segment. You are listening to iHub Radio.
News, weather, and a couple of dozen loudmouths. This is iHub Radio. She calls it as she sees it. Now, here's Anita Rufus.
Okay, I promised I was going to tell you about why this is our last live show on this Saturday morning. We will still be broadcasting. We will still be updating you with lots of news and opinion and policy and politics, all the stuff I normally do. But instead of being able to listen live on Saturday morning from 10 to noon, or reruns that are sometimes available on iHub Radio's site, we're going to go to all podcasts. So this will be my last live episode for the time being. But you can listen on demand as a podcast. In other words, you don't need to meet my schedule. You can just listen whenever you feel like you have some time. There may, in fact, be more than one episode per week because we may cut it into smaller segments instead of a whole 2 hours at once. Wherever you access podcasts, whether it's Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or Spotify or TuneIn or something called Stitcher that I never even heard of, wherever you access podcasts, all you have to do is search. You just put into the search line iHub Radio, two words, iHub Radio. Then you can scroll down, find my show, The Anita Rufus Show, and every episode will be listed, and you can just click into the podcast and listen whenever you feel like it. Now, it turns out, I did not know this, but you can actually subscribe at no cost to this podcast program, and it'll automatically download as new shows are updated every week. If all else fails, you can just go to the iHubRadio.com website, scroll down the right side of the homepage, and you can access the podcast there just by clicking on the logo for my show, The Anita Rufus Show. The nice thing about this is you can listen when you want to. And the nice thing is I can pretty much broadcast when I want to, so that podcasts go up, but I don't always have to be here in the studio at a certain time on a certain day. I love having flexibility. Okay, we have become more and more aware this past week and for the last 3 weeks about the response that has taken place, not just since the death of Mr. Lloyd, but the number of names that can be thrown out for people who were killed by police officers under circumstances that are at the very least questionable about whether what that person did justified the death penalty as determined by a police officer as judge and jury. And the bigger conversation, and I've talked about this a lot on this show, the bigger conversation is about the kind of incipient racism that is at the core of our culture. I have often described it as a cancer at the core of our culture into which we are born. And most of us are raised in circumstances where we don't have a lot of exposure to people of other races or other economic circumstances or from other countries. Once kids go to school, they do find in public school that kind of mixture. But by then, they may have heard inside their own homes the kinds of attitudes or comments or terms used that set in place the kinds of racism where you see other people as lesser. Now, it is true that if you're raised in a rich home, you may, in fact, see poor people as lesser. But a poor person who's dressed nicely and in a place where it's not obvious that they live in a tenement or get food stamps, you have no way of knowing that. But in a society and a culture where there is underlying racism at the core, when you see a black person or a Hispanic, you may make certain judgments about that individual subconsciously that sees them as the other or more dangerous or more in need than you and your friends. And let me tell you, the kind of institutional racism that we have in banking, in education, in housing, in almost every, and certainly in policing, in almost every area of our culture, because our cultural institutions were built on the foundations of when we were founded. And when we were founded, people of color who had been brought here as free labor to help build what this country actually became, those people were not seen as equal. In fact, they were measured as three-fifths of a real person for taxing purposes. So I want to tell you, I saw something this morning with everything else I was going to talk about, the analysis of arrest data of blacks versus whites coming straight from the FBI, that it's not the left that's doing this violence on the streets. But this is something that I just came across this morning, and it jumped out at me as the kind of thing that most of us cannot relate to on a personal level. But you need to know this is your uncle or your next door neighbor or one of your friends where you don't talk too honestly about things like this. The LA Lakers basketball team, the owner of that team is a woman named Jeannie Buss. She marked Juneteenth, which was yesterday, with a message to her white friends that they need to do better, as she shared a very ugly letter sent to her attention on Instagram from a guy who called himself a huge Lakers fan. Here's what his message to her said. Dear whore, after 60 years as a huge Lakers fan, I now say to hell with the overpaid N-word traitors and the NBA. Go to hell and join N-word Kobe Bryant. And he signed his name. I'll give him credit for that. He wasn't embarrassed to be saying that. She responded. Now, normally, you just don't pay any attention to things like that. You take it for what it's worth. But she responded. She said, after much thought, I decided to share this letter I received so that everyone can see the hate is real and living out there. This is happening in our world today. It's real and it exists. And then to Joe Blank, who sent her that hateful Instagram message, she said to Joe, "Did sending this letter make you feel better? Really, all you did was waste your time and energy and your postage stamp, but thank you for including your return home address. Why don't you look in the mirror and see your ugliness? Because I refuse to. I have received letters like this over the years. The advice I always got was to ignore it, and I did. But not anymore." And she concludes her message. "On this day, Juneteenth, I ask my white friends to join together, acknowledge the racism that exists in our country and around the world, and pledge to stop ignoring it. We all must do better." Amen, and congratulations to Jeannie Buss for taking that stand. So, thousands of cities and county police departments all over the country report arrest data to the FBI. And it turns out that in about 800 different jurisdictions around the country, Black people were arrested at a rate 5 times higher than white people in the year 2018. In 250 of those jurisdictions, Black people were 10 times more likely to be arrested. And by the way, that didn't even include data from Florida or Illinois or the New York City Police Department, the country's largest police force, because they don't report demographic data on arrests to the FBI. A woman named Kristen Clark, who is president and executive director of the National Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, said, "The data reveals a pervasive problem. We have to deal with the over-policing of low-income African-American communities in our country. When we see data that shows that African-Americans are singled out, unfairly targeted, disproportionately subject to arrest and prosecution, that should be sounding an alarm." And this is what institutional racism looks like. Yeah, the guy who sent that note to the LA Lakers owner, that's individual racism. That's somebody, you know, that you wouldn't want to have in your circle of friends, frankly. But it is the institutional set in concepts, preconceptions, the way we see other people. The fact that there are people in our own nation who merely because of the color of their skin, because let's face it, you don't know when you see somebody whether they're a criminal, whether they've done something wrong, whether they just came out of prison. You don't know whether they have a job or whether they're being supported by the government or whether they live at home in somebody's basement. But when you see the color of someone's skin, the question is, do you see them as not like you? Do you see them as lesser? Do you see them as other? That's what makes the difference, and that's what is inculcated into all of us in this culture from the time we are born. We have to not only become aware of it, but we have to consciously get rid of it. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal, and this is iHub Radio.
Because you only think you know the truth. Striking blows against the corporate talk radio monolith in the Coachella Valley. iHub Radio. Participation encouraged, but not required. Here's Anita Rufus.
So in the face of what has been going on around the killing of Mr. Floyd and the other killings, Breonna Taylor in particular is the one that just makes me furious. I mean, she was sleeping in her own apartment, for God's sake. Anyway, in the aftermath of the Floyd killing, and with 3 weeks now of protests, and God knows what's going to happen in Tulsa today, American attitudes actually have shifted, at least to some extent. And this is one of the fastest shifts I'm aware of in racial attitudes in recent history in this country. A broad majority of Americans, there was a poll that was done by Yahoo News and YouGov, and they found that a broad majority of Americans now believe that both the police and society as a whole are at the effect of systemic racism. Most Americans in this poll reject President Trump's claim that law and order can solve this problem. YouGov, this company that co-partnered this poll, in 2016, just a quarter of Americans, about 27%, told YouGov that they approved of the Black Lives Matter movement. Today, that's up to 57% who say they have a favorable view of Black Lives Matter. 56% have become more concerned about racial injustice in the country. And so let's be honest. Whatever it is that we end up deciding to do to reform policing, including allocating some of the money we give to police to the kinds of 911 calls that don't require an armed police officer to show up. Nevertheless, 60% of Americans are now saying that racism is built into American society. And that is exactly the definition of what systemic racism is all about. The assumption of white superiority pervades our schools, our businesses, housing, government. And of course, police have a problem with systemic racism. Don't kid yourself. Police departments started in this country, in the South in particular, as a way to enforce slavery, because some of those slaves kept trying to escape. And there had to be some force that would go out and catch them and bring them back. That is the underlying basis of policing in this country. Is it still that way? No. Have they tried to make changes? Yes. Are there a lot of people who go into policing because they want that feeling of carrying a gun and being able to right society's wrongs, which all too often are inculcated into their psyche, that those are the people that cause society's wrongs? Meanwhile, if you wait long enough, the Academy of Motion Arts and Sciences, Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, is working to ensure that films eligible for Oscars will meet diversity and inclusion requirements. Over the next 5 years, the Academy plans to encourage hiring practices that are equitable, working with the Producers Guild to develop a task force of industry leaders to focus on diversity and inclusion standards for Oscar eligibility. I've been watching a lot of old movies at night at home just because I've reached the point where I don't know what else to watch. And old movies are a great way of escaping reality. And I've noticed there's movies, particularly World War II movies, where there is not a single female in the film. Well, maybe a hooker in one of the bars in Hawaii, or maybe a nurse. Meanwhile, the 100 largest U.S. public companies, those that are listed on the stock exchange, have committed over $1.5 billion to organizations that are fighting racism and inequality. 10 companies made up 88% of that total commitment. Bank of America made a four-year, $1 billion pledge. I want to give them congrats for that. But then the next question is, and have you changed the way your loan officers evaluate people who come in for loans who may not be white or already own fairly good-sized businesses? Because loans for businesses and for homes are one of the key ways that banks can support building up some kind of assets within the Black community. Because the wealth gap when it comes to race is outrageous. White households have between 6 and 10 times as much saved in the bank as African-American counterparts. And that is unchanged for decades and decades. The ability, for example, to save up for retirement is often something that people get as part of their job. But people of color are overrepresented in service sector jobs. Those are low-wage jobs, and they don't have quality benefits. We have to re-envision the way our economic system works. Redlining and the problem with getting loans is why Black families, generally speaking, don't have assets that they can draw on, for example, when there is a crisis. They can't borrow against a home if they couldn't get a loan to buy a home in the first place. Anyway, I want to share with you, I found this wonderful quote from a writer named Jennifer Senior. It was in an editorial column that she wrote in the Los Angeles Times, and I just love it because it says everything that you need to know about how this particular administration is not dealing with this issue in any effective way. Jennifer Senior said, when Trump asked voters, "What have you got to lose?" most of us never dreamed that the answer could be everything. This is Anita Rufus, the lovable liberal. My last live show on Saturday morning, and this is iHub Radio.